Haig, welcome to SBS Radio's Armenian program.
Thank you, Vahel. Thank you very much.
Haig, for our listeners who don't know you, a bit about yourself and what do you do these days?
Within the community, I currently chair the Armenian Revolutionary Federation Australian Central Committee. Prior to that, I was working within the Armenian National Committee's National Board. And even before that, I was involved in the Armenian Youth Federation of Australia as well. Professionally, I'm actually a journalist by tertiary qualification. However, soon after starting my career, I opened my own web development digital agency practice, and that's what I do to today.
Haig, today's topic is the elections in Armenia. You wrote several articles about the subject. What are the main changes expected when the system is changed from presidential to parliamentary system?
Look, that is a very important question, Vahe, considering that the elections on April 2nd is going to be electing an entirely new type of government for the Republic of Armenia. And the election process, or the electoral process as well, is going to be very different to what it's been in the past. And it is quite important to understand these changes. The constitutional changes that have been adopted mean that what we are voting for in Armenia today, or what the citizens of Armenia are voting for in Armenia today, is a government which is going to operate in a parliamentary system of governance. What we used to vote for in Armenia was a semi-presidential model of government. So we used to have the parliamentary elections, and the parliament would be in charge of certain things. However, we would also have the presidential elections, which would always trump the parliamentary elections. The reason for that is, in a semi-presidential model of governance like Armenia had, the president has final say on a lot of key matters. For example, foreign policy, defense as commander-in-chief, and there was very, very difficult for the parliament to influence some of the larger decisions that were being taken in the country. So what the constitution has allowed for, in short, is an option for all the members of the National Assembly, the parliament that get elected on April 2nd, to be the prime governors of the Republic of Armenia for the coming 5 years. There will no longer be a president elected by the people. There will be a president appointed by this body that they are electing as the parliament for the coming 5 years, and the president will have no authority or say on any decisions. It's not based on an individual anymore. It's based on a collective. The second most important reform that came after the constitutional reform is the electoral process reform. And the way the elections are going to be run on April 2nd is going to be entirely different to the way they have been run before. First, because they are electing no single individual. They're electing a whole parliament of 101 seats minimum. But they're also electing in a way which is meant to be a lot more free and fair. We can go into that, of course, if you wish.
Yeah, sure, we can continue.
Sure. So basically, the electoral process in Armenia has been considered rigged since the mid-90s. They say that the first ever election since independence were probably the last ones that Armenia had, which was free and fair. And the results of that election were pretty much known before the elections actually took place. What happened in the mid-90s is a process began on how to corrupt election results, which is quite popular in post-Soviet states. And the main reason for that is obviously the fight for power, fight for money, fight for everything else that governance brings in the type of state that we have lived in for the last 25 years since independence. The ARF was the prime pusher from those early years of independence to try to move to a parliamentary model of governance. And in order to achieve that, it was important to look at the last 25 years of electoral rigging and to try to legislate against it in the electoral reforms process. The beauty of the new electoral code that Armenia has adopted is that the vast majority of the parties and blocs that are participating in the April 2 elections have actually signed up to them. They suggested a lot of changes to what was put up by the ruling party, went back and forth, but they accepted what is now in place as the most free and fair way to move forward. This was important because even that decision, basically, you need to be comfortable with the environment in which you're participating in as a candidate for any elections that you participate in. The electoral code basically has removed the ability to rig the vote at the electoral booth. What I mean by this is some of the things that used to occur in the Armenian elections, for example, were people would vote multiple times. There are numbers out there that suggest the last presidential elections, there were between 200,000 and 300,000 multiple voters which should have been disqualified votes from the election. That is a significant number when you're in a country of about 2 million or so voters. Basically, this has now been removed in this new electoral code because the election, the voters list will be published. Basically, the public, the different parties are going to be able to see every single name who voted. And if any name appears twice, then basically that will be a disqualified vote. This means that it has removed that particular issue that used to happen at the electoral booth. Secondly, there used to be bullying at the electoral booths. When people used to go to their booth to vote, they would be asked to pick up certain voting cards, and then after they go into the private booth, which sometimes people would follow them into that booth, by the way, after they left that booth, they would see, you know, what vote they did before they could put it into the ballot box. Then there used to be things at the counting, during counting, number of ballots would disappear, boxes would disappear, et cetera, et cetera. All of this part is also sorted with the current electoral code, because what it's actually allowing for is a live online feed of every single electoral booth that has internet connectivity, which is about 80-85% of the electoral booths that are out there are going to be equipped with cameras, which is going to allow anybody from the public to watch every single electoral booth in the Republic of Armenia on election day live. Therefore, not only is there policing within every single electoral station, there's also the public which can act as citizen patrol for these sort of methods. So a lot of transparency once you get to the electoral booth. Nobody is able to bully you into voting for them. Nobody is able to directly be involved while you actually vote. And once you have voted and you leave the station, what you tell them outside and what you don't tell them, there's no way of actually proving that. All of these are obviously very important reforms, and it's taking Armenia towards the path of more democratic, free and fair elections. It's not going to be fully fair and democratic, and the reason for that is a lot of the other issues that have been associated with Armenian election riggings actually are not policeable. What I mean by that is what they call in Armenian andragashark, buying votes. So the wealthier parties in the Armenian political landscape have the finances to offer citizens of Armenia who are not doing so well 10,000, 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 or 50,000 dirhams, and in exchange for that, ask them or demand that they vote for their party when they come to the elections. The reason this is not policeable, it's actually an exchange of funds for a service in the privacy of somebody's home, somebody's shop. It's somewhere that we don't know occurs. And the person who accepts the money, unless they actually speak up and say, look, I was offered this and I took it, which not many people would say, it's actually even something that is reported. However, it is happening today like it has happened in past elections. One thing that we're not sure how it's going to play out is whether after taking this money, they will actually go and vote for the party they promised to vote for. Because based on what I said earlier, the electoral booth is actually a sacred place based on the reforms in the electoral code. Therefore, technically, a citizen can accept the funds from party A and promise them that they will vote for them, but they can then go into the electoral booth in the privacy of that booth and vote for the party of their choice. And the party A would actually not know whether they have done, whether they have voted or not. So it's a very risky proposition these days to try to buy votes, but we do know that it is occurring. There are reports of it, you know, left, right and center, but Whether it's going to have as much of an impact as it's had in past elections, we're not sure, because the market drivers of that particular exchange of the cash in exchange for the vote has become more risky. One thing that's also important to note is what's happening once they get to the electoral station. There are 9 parties and blocs that are participating in the election. Every single voter will pick up 9 different ballot papers, one that represents each party, each bloc. They will go into their private electoral booth, which will be an enclosed area, just like we have here in Australia and like they have in the States and Canada, etc. And in that booth, there is a bin. And what they will do is they will only pick the party or bloc of their choice and place that ballot paper in an envelope. And that envelope is what they will put into the final boxes that are collected. The other 8 ballot papers, they can dispose of within the bin. So there is actually no way of knowing whether they have voted for your party or not voted for your party once they leave the electoral station. The one thing that is also noteworthy is a step they are free to take, but they don't have to. Once they pick the party of their choice, so for example, if they pick the Republican Party or the Tsarugyan bloc, before putting it in the envelope, they can turn that sheet, that ballot sheet over, and they can also tick a candidate in their local area of their choice from that party. So one of the key constitutional electoral reforms here is the elections, on, just like Australia in this case, it's not actually based around an individual. A lot of people in Australia even feel that they're going and voting for Malcolm Turnbull or Kevin Rudd or whoever it is at the head of that party. But what we are actually voting for, as we all know, is the party, the Labor Party, the Liberal Party, the Greens, or whoever it is that we prefer to vote for. And we're voting for our local candidate of that party. If that party actually gets up at the end of the day, yes, their leader becomes Prime Minister. But just like we've seen here in Australia, the Prime Minister can always change without the people going to the polls. The Armenian elections, it's important that it's gone down to this reform path, in my opinion, because for too long it has been based on individuals. And something that's based on individuals is a lot more easy to corrupt as opposed to something that's based on a collective.
With the parliamentary system, is it possible for an outside power to put pressure on Armenia as it was possible with the presidential system?
Theoretically, that's a very, very good question. Theoretically, it should be more difficult. Basically, with the presidential system, where foreign policy, which is so important in Armenia's situation, geopolitical situation, is decided and signed off by one person, the president. The foreign minister is currently appointed by the president. Nobody else gets a say in the appointment of the foreign minister. And an outside power, and I'm not saying this has been done, of course I have my suspicions just like you do, but an outside power can obviously have a lot more influence on one individual than they can have on a collective. And we see it play out in our own political systems in the West. It's a lot more difficult for somebody to get things through a parliament when there is a debate on that parliament. I'll give you an example of one of the ways that this is going, influencing Armenia is going to be a lot more difficult under the new model. And I'm very proud of this model because obviously the party that I support, the ARF, has been behind lobbying for these changes for 25 years. One of the mechanisms that's in place is there will be a minimum opposition in the coming parliament. What does that mean? So if the government is formed in a majority by the Republican Party or the Tsarugyan bloc or a coalition of 2-3 different parties, and those 2-3 different parties, or that one party that wins the election, ends up with 80% of the vote. Very unlikely, but let's just assume that it's possible. Technically, that means that the opposition will only be 20%, right? What the new electoral code and the new constitution has embedded in it is a minimum opposition of 33%. Therefore, even if the opposition does not make up 33% of the parliament, their seats will be increased to become commensurate with 33% of the House. Why this is important is something else in the Constitution, is committees can be formed for inquiries and key inquiries into decisions such as foreign policy, such as defence, etc., etc., with only 25% of the vote. So if you are an opposition, you will have technically a third of the House as opposition party or parties. And with that third of the House, you can actually form inquiries and committees which will entice and encourage and basically enforce public debate around key decisions around the country. So even within the parliament, there are new mechanisms in place which if an entire party, an entire coalition of two parties, three parties is corrupted by an outside force, the one third that's sitting there can still hold that government to account. So definitely it's going to be a lot more difficult. It's going to be a lot more difficult first because it's not about convincing one person. That's standard. But also the fact that there will be a more vociferous opposition with powers that they haven't had in the past, that too will be another way that Armenia will be a lot more fair and just when it comes to trying to repel outside influence.
Harik, there have been suggestions that President Sarkisian wants to retain power and become prime minister in 2018. Is this possible?
Yeah. Look, I think he hasn't actually come out and made an announcement that he's not going to do that. Basically, what's happened with the ruling Republican Party is they've changed prime ministers since the events of the last year. And the prime minister, who was Hovig Abrahamyan, is now Garen Garabedian. And Garen Garabedian has given us a new, fresh image for the Republican Party. Now, the people, say, I mean, there are polls out there. Gallup does a poll in Armenia, and there's also a Russian-backed poll also in Armenia. The people apparently are approving of Garen Garabedian's performance. In one poll, it was 77%, and in another poll, it was 82%. So this individual has come in and given the party of Serge Sarkisian a fresh look and basically has attracted some following despite having a very difficult relationship with the people over the last 10 years in power. Logic, therefore, states that it's not in the interests of the Republican Party to not back Garen Garabedian all the way. Garen Garabedian is being fancied by a lot of people, right or wrong, that's for everybody to decide. As somebody who is wealthy, he's done very well for himself in business, therefore is less likely to use the government as a means for his income, because his income is derived from elsewhere and he's already a multimillionaire. He's a very polished performer, he's a businessman, he's a manager. All of these things that the people seem to be liking, he's running the government in a very different way to his predecessor. So Serge Sarkisian can technically become prime minister if he chooses to and his party decides is the best path for their party in 2018 after he's done with his presidential duties. He had made an announcement 24 hours ago when he was meeting with the military in Artsakh, that he sees his post-2018 role in Armenia as not one of retirement, however, one involved in maintaining the security of Armenia. So if we're going to try to read between the lines of what he's saying, he wants to remain involved in the security aspect of Armenia. That, as we all know, can be done in positions other than as the Prime Minister of the Republic of Armenia. It can be done in different segments in the defense ministry, which he used to be a part of back then. It could be done in military command posts, etc., which he's also been involved in during the Artsakh liberation movement, etc. So my answer to that question is technically, yes, he can become prime minister if his party has the majority down the road. However, I believe the more Garen Garabedian's performance is being praised, the less likely a Serge Sarkisian as the head of government will be. Look, the other thing that makes me think it's unlikely, and again, you know, I'm hoping it's unlikely, I'll be honest with you. I don't think that it's healthy for a country to have as its main figurehead somebody, you know, for more than 10 years, regardless of all, you know, putting all of his faults aside and what, you know, opinions can be of him. You know, we were very divided against him when it came to the protocols, for example. So, you know, we've got our opinions there. However, when it comes to Serge Sargsyan and returning to become the main figurehead of the country, I don't think it's likely because, you know, would a president who's been able to sit at 26 Bagramyan and hand out orders want to be sitting in parliament every single day answering questions from a vociferous opposition? It requires a different leadership altogether, different type of leadership altogether. You know, I just don't think this system is suited to a prime minister who has been a president in the past.
Hayk, you spoke about electoral bloc. What is it compared to a party?
So an electoral, a party compared to a bloc. So a bloc is a collective of parties that have come together to ask for the vote as a collective of parties from the people. So a coalition is different because, you know, if you get into government or if the, once the voting is done and one party can't become government, they don't have the required 54%, which is what's mandated right now. If they don't have the 54% to form government in their own right, they can negotiate with other parties on blocks to become a coalition government. And the maximum number of parties that can unite to become government is three. A bloc is different because they're actually deciding to partner before the election. And the election platform that they come up with, the election list of candidates that they come up with, are being brought together before the elections. So, you know, there's a bloc like Yelk, for example. It involves three different parties, a civil contract party, the Republic Party, not to be confused with the Republican Party, and the, I think it's the Bright Armenia Party. You got these three political parties with three very different, technically, ideologies coming together before the election, uniting around the program, dividing the list of candidates that they have between their parties and presenting themselves before the Armenian people to request their vote. A political party is basically just one party, and there's there's a few of those as well that are participating out of the nine.
Hayk, are there any real political parties in Armenia besides the traditional political parties like ARF? Because you spoke about it, many of these parties or blocs are founded by individuals.
Look, I think that's a very, very good question. You know, one of the things that I've been very critical of in this election campaign so far, and it will continue that way, is the lack of ideology that exists in politics. I mean, here in the West, here in Australia, the US, etc., as individuals, we have an ideology. We have a way that we think that government should be done. Some of us believe that it should be very conservative. Government should be small. You know, businesses should have less red tape, which means less taxes, etc. And if we allow businesses that free rein, therefore the businesses will employ more people, etc., etc. So, you know, those conservative parties tend to have a smaller government, which means they contribute less to people's healthcare and other means or whatever. And therefore, they vote for those conservative party in their country or the conservative bloc of parties in their country. Whereas the others among us are more what we call left of center. And what they believe is for a more progressive government. They believe that business, those who are making a lot more money should be taxed a lot more to give a lot more to those who are earning less money. And the government tends to become larger. And therefore, the government expenditure, you know, reaches education a little bit further, reaches health, et cetera, et cetera. This sort of clear division of ideologies doesn't exist in the Armenian political debate today, whether they are a single political party or whether they are a bloc. In fact, even more if they are a bloc. What you have is the traditional parties. Let's talk about traditional parties. You've got the Armenian Revolutionary Federation, which is a socialist political party, clearly left of center. It's got an ideology, 127-year history. No individual makes decisions at the high end of that particular party. Meetings do it. There's a presence in 30-plus countries, et cetera, et cetera. So that is a more traditional political party when it comes to what we are used to here in the West. Another more traditional party, which is one that hopefully won't get more than the 1% that it's expected to get, therefore won't go into parliament, is the Communist Party. Now, regardless of what we think of the communists, and I'm not going to ever speak kindly about communists, they are very grounded in their ideology. Right? We know what they stand for. Like, at least we know that communists want whatever it is that communists wanted during the Soviet days. The Republican Party of Armenia, it's debatable whether it's a real party when you talk about ideology, because while their policies, their leadership, their makeup reminds us of, the Liberal Party here in Australia, the Republican Party, any right-wing party in the West, basically they have good friends in the business community and they try to do most of their good deeds through business as opposed to through government. They also say that their ideology is Nejdehagan. I think Karekin Nejde, who was a hero of the Armenian world in yesteryear, but a member of the socialist ARF and a socialist, true to his core, he made some very sort of nationalistic statements throughout his life. And based on those statements, the Republican Party say that they are Nejdehagan in ideology, but in practice, what they actually are is a right-wing political party. However, I accept them as a right-wing political party because even their international memberships are with right-wing political party collectives. The Dzarugyan bloc with Gagik Dzarugyan as the head. Gagik Dzarugyan is a very well-known oligarch in Armenia, known as a benevolent oligarch in some cases where he hands out money and gives back to the community here and there. He's expected to be in the top two when all the counting is done in these elections. And when you look at his policy platform, you feel like hitting your head against the wall because it just doesn't make sense. A guy who is an oligarch is not proposing to increase 1 cent of tax on his fellow elite, has proposed a 15-point program, which will increase Armenia's spending to around $500 billion in the next 5 years. The current Armenian budget or revenue is $1.2 billion a year. So it's around $5 billion over 5 years, $6 billion over 5 years. He's proposing to increase that with his 15-point program to what's estimated to be around $500 billion, because what he's offering, this benevolent oligarch, is offering increase in Armenian wages, three-year exemptions for small and medium businesses. He's going to reduce the price of gas and electricity. He's going to pay for every students' education. He's basically going to be the most socialist, right-wing, conservative leader that the world has ever seen. You look at this sort of contradiction and you say that the Dzarugyan bloc, while it's definitely got credibility in the eyes of the people where they hear things like this and, a lot of them are below the lines of poverty, and therefore they're going to be supporting this guy. But you look at that party and it doesn't exude confidence because you don't know what they're actually going to do. You can't, it just doesn't make sense unless you agree to increase the spending like he's suggesting, but suggest no revenue from fellow oligarchs like himself. There are contradictions when parties aren't traditional. You've got the Yelp bloc, which we discussed before. That's probably one of the more credible blocs that came together. But a bloc that is brought together because of a common enemy, just like, relationships that are brought together because you have a common enemy, those relationships don't tend to last too long because you have nothing else in common. The problem with the Yelp bloc, they have a common enemy. Yelp means a way out. They're offering the people a way out of Republican control, which is a very popular way to approach things. However, what they're not suggesting is what they're going to do after that, because I don't think the three of them agree, the three parties that are in the Yoke Bloc, actually agree on what needs to happen after, because you've got, you know, Pashinyan and Marukyan within that bloc, who have actually been disagreeing on a lot of things over recent years, including entry into the Eurasian Economic Union and alliance with Russia, and Aram Sarkisyan, who's a former prime minister under a Republican government, and he's been a very, you know, big promoter of the Russian-Armenian relationship, while the other two are talking about, you know, trying to align with the West. So, you know, these coalitions that have formed, or the blocs that have formed at a critical juncture in Armenia's history, which is what I consider ourselves to be in right now, considering what happened in Artsakh on the 2nd of April, the fact that the international community is promoting a pro-Azeri agenda when it comes to the resolution of the Artsakh conflict, you know, you need to have stable leadership, or you prefer to have stable leadership. And what a lot of these blocs that have come together are not showing us is stable leadership. The other one that's making a lot of noise is the Oro bloc, or the Ohanian, Rafi, or Skanian bloc. You know, Rafi Hovhannisyan is involved in that bloc. He has been a strong critic of both Vartan Oskanyan and Seyran Ohanian over the last 20 years. He's been a major opposition force with his Jaran Kutyun party. He took an unpopular decision to join this bloc, where key people from his party, including Zaruri Postanjan, left his party because he joined this bloc of former government ministers. And now he's sitting at the table with these guys, and when you hear them talk, they're all talking about something else. You know, there is no continuity. So to answer your question in that, you know, with that long preamble, I think that you know what you're going to get with the ARF. There's no doubt about that. You know what you're going to get with the communists, but please don't go communist. But in terms of the other parties that are out there, there are debatable ideological beginnings. Although if something looks right-wing, if something looks like they will be aligning themselves with this or that force, that's probably what they are. One party I haven't discussed in that answer is the Armenian National Congress, Levon Derbedrosyan's party, but maybe we can cover him with a separate question.
About Levon Derbedrosyan, he drew a lot of criticism about his views that giving away the liberated territories is the key to peace between Armenian and Azerbaijan and also Turkey. Are his views new, or is the same that forced him to resign back in 1998?
Levon Derbedrosyan is the ultimate opportunist in politics in Armenia. He was in the right place, right time when we gained independence, and he became the first president. Technically, we liberated Artsakh under his presidency, which should be something that should have silver-lined his legacy. However, as you mentioned, Vahe, he actually was forced to resign because he decided to give those lands back then, and then return to the negotiation table. Basically, during those times, most of what we were hearing and saying about Levon Derbedrosyan, and let's keep in mind that it wasn't the Facebook age that we are in today, where everybody knows everything, or at least thinks they know everything. Levon Derbedrosyan was outed by people around him. He wasn't outed by the people. And the reason for that is, you know, they told us that it was the fact that he had the sort of views that he's actually talking about now. So I don't think that they're different. I don't think they're new views that he's expressing now, but he is actually expressing them. That's the difference. There is a very strong message in that particular thing, which I'll talk about in a moment, the fact that he is expressing them. So firstly, what we need to understand is there are two views regarding Artsakh. There are two views. And when the elections began, or the pre-election sort of campaign began, there were a lot more views. But now they have solidified into two very distinct views. Number one is Levon's view, which is the Congress Ajager bloc that exists. And number two is the Tashnakstrom view, the ARF view. So what Levon is saying is what has been put on the table for Serge Sargsyan and the current Armenian ruling party to sign by the OSCE mediators is as follows. Armenia hands back seven territories, or at least six of seven territories, back to Azerbaijan. Now, the wording of this is already something that Armenians, like I personally, am not comfortable with. Back to Azerbaijan. Now, for us, that they never belonged to Azerbaijan, right? So liberated territories, they are calling occupied territories. Levon is doing that. That we are occupying territories that were historically ours. And basically, after handing those back, we are actually getting something in return. When people are asking them, what are you getting in return? What he is saying is we are getting peace in return. So the negotiation here is we give back territory, right? And in exchange, we gain peace, which is a word, right? It's actually not something tangible. What does peace mean? By handing back territories, we would have actually brought Azerbaijan closer to Armenia's borders, not only Karabakh's borders. We would have actually brought Azerbaijan close to Armenia's borders, right? Within the agreement that Levon wants us to sign, what he is saying is one day in the future, Azerbaijan will allow for a referendum on Artsakh to determine whether it becomes a self-governed region within Azerbaijan. So Karabakh remains part of Azerbaijan, but it becomes a self-governed region, or it becomes a completely a part of Azerbaijan, or whether it becomes the best-case scenario, which is a republic, an independent republic, or a part of Armenia. Now, basically, the referendum that Karabakh decided 25 years ago, Levon is basically saying that that is not worth anything, not worth the paper it's signed on, because the international community has not recognized it. Therefore, let's throw that away. Let's hand liberated territories to Azerbaijan, which they shouldn't have had in the first place. And then we'll have the promise of one day going into a referendum, which might actually give us what we already have now. But in the meantime, he's bringing the enemy closer to Armenia. So that's the Levon view, because peace for him is everything. For his, if you look at the policy platform of his party and his bloc, he's actually saying that the reason we have emigration from Armenia at record levels, the reason we have an economy that is not progressing, the reason we have this is basically the Karabakh war. So when you take this, you know, thing out of the equation, our borders will open with Turkey, with Azerbaijan, and Armenia will be prosperous. Nobody will be leaving Armenia anymore, etc., etc. Now, basically what he's doing is he's bringing the enemy closer to Armenia and then opening Armenia's doors to them. That's his view. The Tashnakstrom view, which is now the view of the majority of the players in these elections on Artsakh, is very different. It's not that we are not going to negotiate on territories, but territorial concessions need to be as part of a mutual dialogue. And for us to discuss handing territories or receiving territories, Azerbaijan first needs to recognize the independence or the rights to self-determination of the Republic of Artsakh. Basically, if Artsakh is not considered independent by Azerbaijan, then why are we going to hand territories to Azerbaijan? That is what we call a one-sided concession. That is the Levon argument. The ARF argument is the international community wants us to make mutual concessions. They want that. So we're not going to get away with not giving anything back ever, probably. But to get to that point where we possibly give back and take in a mutual discussion, a mutual dialogue, we first need a prerequisite to be undertaken, which is Azerbaijan recognizing the independence of Artsakh. In the meantime, yes, the status quo will evolve. And the ARF, for example, will use its international reach, as well as encourage the government of Armenia to do the same, to get other countries to recognize the independence and the rights to self-determination of Artsakh. if Artsakh is recognized by countries other than Azerbaijan, it will change what is going on in the mutual dialogue right now. So these are the two primary views that are being presented. Levon is alone in expressing his views. However, most of the other parties have now jumped on the bandwagon of the ARF view. Now, what was significant in the beginning of this answer that I gave you, Vahe, is Levon wasn't outwardly expressing this in the early 90s. He is outwardly expressing this today. I believe, and this is, you know, purely subjective, I believe the reason for that is because the opportunist that he is realizes that the only way Levon will be in a ruling government again in Armenia, or possibly prime minister of Armenia, is if those parties outside Armenia, such as America, Russia, France, Turkey, etc., who are pushing the same views that he is pushing, unless they come in and somehow become involved with some sort of an interventionist plan like they've done in other countries, which we all know of, Levon has no hope of returning to government, probably not even with opposition seats. So I think that that's the reason he's expressing them now, but as I said, that's subjective.
Haik, is ARF campaigning alone or in a coalition with the ruling party?
Sure. Look, obviously the ambiguity that some people have felt regarding that question is because the ARF joined in a pseudo-coalition with the ruling party before these elections because of the fact that they were pushing these constitutional reforms. It was a way of actually seeing through those reforms. That was the explanation, and that is what has actually eventuated. However, the ARF will never participate in elections on somebody else's platform. The ARF has an ideology, has a platform that's decided by their World Congress, which is held every four years. That World Congress decides what our policies are on Artsakh, decides what our key policies are, social policies for Armenia. It's based on a socialist, a certain nationalist agenda, and that is not shared by any party in the Armenian scene. Therefore, the ARF is participating as a lone party in these elections. The other question that people usually ask at this point is, okay, but if they get into parliament, will they form a coalition again with the ruling Republican Party? That is not exempted. It is not exempted that the ARF will form a coalition with any party. However, the ARF has proven that it never bargains its policies. So if its key policies are adopted by the ruling, whoever it is that has a chance to form a coalition for the Armenian government, then they will take that on. But the bargaining of the ARF policies will not happen. We will always be arguing for the same things, whether in government or whether in opposition. So there is no exemption that after all is said and done, whether we will form a coalition with the ruling party or with any other party that is able to form government. But the key thing with the ARF is the policies that we are pushing is it's a stable set of hands on the wheel, and that will always be beneficial to whoever is in government in Armenia. However, the ARF is actually going into these elections hoping to form government in its own right. As unlikely as it is with this new political system, the key thing is that we have established a framework for the people of Armenia to move on to the trajectory of democratization.
Haik, do you see any particular interest or concern from the diaspora about these elections?
Yes, I do. Of course, I do. I think the fact that we are living in the information age, there is a lot more information of the injustices during elections of the past, and also a lot more information about the sort of elections that we are about to embark upon as Armenians. The diaspora is definitely interested. I can see that conversations are about these elections. People actually know some of the policies around the blocs, etc. The articles that I've written, the articles that others are writing, there's a publication that launched in the last week in Armenia in English about this. So you can see that the interest is there in the diaspora. The actions of the diaspora has obviously been a few groups have been coming together, including a group of celebrity Armenians, encouraging people to go to Armenia and be observers in the election. So you can, you know, observe the electoral booths and observe the counting, which will also, as I said, be, you know, live streamed online. Basically, the interest is definitely there. And I think the diaspora should be interested, because one of the fantastic things within the new constitution that we've got is the new government, the one that is going to be elected for the next 5 years, the constitution demands that they come up with a way for the diaspora to actually be represented in the government within the next 5 years by in time for the next elections. So basically, you know, our interest at the moment is as fellow Armenians, you know, as humanitarians, as, you know, everything that we are, our interest is there. That is our haereni. However, the government that's being elected here will actually be providing the framework for how diaspora members, diaspora Armenians, will be represented in the next Armenian government. There are actually going to be seats in the government for members of the diaspora. So it's actually a very important election. And the next 5 years will be very important for the diaspora to follow in Armenia.
Are there seats reserved to minorities in the National Assembly?
Yes, there are. There are four seats to the four largest minorities. That's the constitutional demands. Therefore, in the current, based on the current census in Armenia, the four, as in the most recent census, I should say, the four seats are going to go to the Yazidi community, the Kurdish community, the Russian community, and the Assyrian community. So each of these communities will get one seat each, which will be on top of the 101 seat parliament that is being formed.
Haik, thank you very much for the interview and the information, the extensive information you gave. We talk again after the elections.
Thank you very much, Vahe.